from WCPB Channel 5 podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. Today's guest, Kevin Paul DuPont, Bruins writer extraordinaire for the Boston Globe. We're going to delve into the Bruins' playoff run and their first round win against the Washington Capitals. Also, the future of Tuukka Rask in net. Every single bounce of the puck for him seems to be a referendum on whether he's the right goalie for the Bruins. We asked KPD whether the Bruins are legitimate Stanley Cup contenders. Also, when you look at the Bruins and their core, they won their only Stanley Cup 10 years ago. Is this their last best chance for a second cup? And Ellen asked KPD about his penchant for nicknames. He has some pretty memorable ones. And we also asked Kevin about the most important question right now in the NHL. And that is Canada going to let American-based teams come into Canada for the NHL semifinals? This is a big deal, people. The Canadian border is still closed. There's one entire division of Canadian teams. The NHL Stanley Cup playoff setup this year is based on divisions. You have the North Division, all Canadian teams. So once you have a winner out of that division after the first two rounds, are they going to have to come to the United States and set up camp, or will teams be able to go back and forth across the border? Ellen, what do you think about this? I think if Canada as a country were to make an exception for one thing in the face of a global pandemic, it would be hockey.
Do you think they thought this far ahead? Did they think they was going to be like all fixed by now?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we all did, to be honest. I was just thinking for Chronicle, we get our tree, the Christmas finanza every year.
Yeah.
Our tree's from Canada.
Oh, interesting.
And it couldn't cross the border this year. So they had to put it on a boat and get it like shipped out and brought in through the sea. Now,
what?
I don't know the legality of that, but like, is that an option?
I would say it's probably not an option for the NHL players, but it is going to be really interesting because no Canadian team has won the Stanley Cup since Montreal in 1993. And that is a sticking spot for Canadian citizens. This is their game.
Well, they're all taught. I mean, they love hockey,
they
and yet they
hockey.
Can't seem to win.
That's true. That's very true. But this is a real sticking point for them. So the Toronto Maple Leafs might have a really good chance to win the cup. But wouldn't that be lessened if they can't host home games? I mean, whether the fans are there or not, just the idea you're playing in your arena, you're in your locker room, it's your ice surface. That's an advantage. And now all of a sudden they're telling you like, no, you have to go to Buffalo and play your home games there and then play the road games like against the Bruins at the Garden in front of a full or nearly full TD Garden, full-throated fans. That would seem like a major disadvantage. So I don't know. I think Justin Trudeau on that basis alone would look at and say, for the national security and pride of Canada, we have to open the border and give special dispensation to NHL players, get these American teams across the border to give the Canadian team in the semifinals the very best chance of bringing the Stanley Cup back where it belongs, back home to Canada.
I mean, I think like every athlete of every single sport, they will be given their special privilege to play their sport because God forbid it doesn't happen. So I really have no concern. They will be able to play their sport. Canada will be able to have their pride of hockey, even though they probably will lose, and we'll still be in a pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. It's a very interesting sort of part here of what's going to happen with the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs. Hopefully the Bruins are still around for that, and the Bruins have to figure out whether they can cross the Canadian border or not. That seems to be sort of the red line right now in the NHL. Red line, blue line, goal line, all of it. We're going to talk that next with Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right. Now, as promised, we're joined by the one, the only Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe, Hockey Hall of Fame writer. KPD, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. So let's start here with this. The Bruins, to me, seem like a different team after the trade deadline, bringing in Taylor Hall, defenseman Mike Riley, and fourth line center Curtis Lazar. When you look at this team, would they be in the position they're in after beating the Washington Capitals in just five games in the first round if Don Sweeney hadn't made these moves?
No, absolutely not. They were at best a borderline playoff team. That said, I think they had enough points stored, but in terms of just their talent at the time, they were a borderline playoff team. But they are now arguably the favorite in the division. And it's specifically because of those three and getting some people healthy, like Brandon Carlo when they were making those deals. He was not healthy, but for the obvious reasons, Hall filling out the second line and giving Krejci some life and some hope after years now of trying to come up with dependable second line scoring and good 5-on-5 scoring. So that enhanced the second line. It enhanced the 5-on-5. Riley really has helped them move the puck out, but especially at the offensive blue line, his work around there, contributing and making things just flow better. I would say Lazar, the least important of the three, but has been significant in terms of what he's contributed to that fourth line. It's meant Corrali shifting over, which is okay. Corrali's fine over there. I think you can make a case that he might even be better over there. So in whole, all three were excellent moves, and the price was very, very reasonable.
Yeah, I want to ask you, I mean, obviously you've been doing this now for,
too long.
Yeah, too long. I mean, you know, what, 40, 45 years? Somewhere in that vicinity? Can you think of another Bruins team that got such a boost from what they did at the trade deadline?
No, not in whole like this. They went out and got Ally Afraidy, so that would have been 1994. Ally Afraidy was a significant player for them. So I would say there, but not in terms of taking a team that I felt really wasn't in it or was going to be easily eliminated in the first round. This one in the much more holistic picture.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think for so many years, Kevin, and you've covered this team, it's Bruins fans have felt like they sort of got left at the altar at the trade deadline. Going back to the days of Bourque and Neely, the team would look at it and you'd say as a fan, oh, we just need that one more piece, you know, just that one more piece to get over the finish line. And a lot of years it seemed like Harry Sinnen wouldn't add that one more piece, whether it was his choice or Jeremy Jacobs or just an organizational philosophy for the Bruins. So I like this idea of what Don Sweeney did at the trade deadline. And I know they didn't have to give up a ton, obviously, to do it. But it's interesting because this is sort of an alternate universe where the Bruins are the team that goes for it a little bit at the trade deadline. And I know, look, before with Peter Chiarelli, they did it, Caberle, and I'm going back to the days of Sinden. But when you just sort of look at it, as I said, this is almost kind of like the anti-Bruins to make all these moves at the trade deadline that catapult them into contention.
It really has been an interesting time under Don Sweeney in terms of being aggressive at the trade deadline. So if we go back, as you have here, to those, well, mid-'80s, late-'80s, early-'90s, the era better known as, when are you going to get us a sniper, Harry? and the sniper never showed up, did he?
No,
he didn't. And that said, I don't. If we went back and looked at the 88, 90 teams that played Edmonton in the final, I don't think they were one player away. Would it have been great to get that guy? Of course, it's always great. That said, fans have a pretty short. I was going to say memory, but their expectations are. You know, it's not that easy to go out and get the sniper who might be the 40 or 45 goal guy. Teams don't give them up. You don't get them at the last minute swing through Kmart on aisle 9. Those are trades you have to build to. Now, how did they get Cam Neely? That was in the offseason, and they gave up Barry Peterson. So those trades aren't really reasonable. That said, Don Sweeney in both cases, in two very high-profile cases here, has gone out and arguably gotten that player. So went out and got Rick Nash, as you remember, from the Rangers. That was the deal of the trade deadline. It didn't work out, but I think it was the right trade. It didn't work out because Rick Nash soon got concussed and retired in a matter of weeks. Now, would he have done that anyway? Probably not. I think he just got. I think Rick Nash got to the point in his career where he had made, I think, $97 million over the course of his career. He'd had a handful of concussions. And why not be able to go sit on the porch and at least be able to count the money otherwise? So that's where that one went. This time he got this is Don Sweeney. He went out and got Taylor Hall. And really the cards really fell in the Bruins' favor here in terms of a player who wanted to come here, had the, if you will, restrictive clout in his wallet in terms of a no trade, no move clause, and could name the city he wanted to go to. Taylor Hall had bargained here in the fall to try to land a long-term contract of good dollars. They couldn't come to term here. So we went to Buffalo thinking it was sort of a safe harbor, one-year deal at $8 million. And I would say the engineering was correct, but the team was wrong. It turned out to be a bad, bad year for another bad, bad year for Buffalo. So there you go. I mean, it really, you know, if we go back to find the sniper, he did. And we'll see how it plays out. What I did bring up in Wednesday morning's paper, as you try to frame whether a team really has a great chance to win a cup, the standard, as I call it, porridge of horror, is even when you get the right guys and you look like you're in the right position as they are today, that porridge of horror is always injury and the serendipity at the bounce of the puck.
Yes.
That's a big factor. And the third factor, and we see this in every series, every night, we will see it tonight. We will see it 10 years from now. And when I'm long gone, the vagaries of officiating. There's no sport. I know you've watched far more NBA than
yes.
I have.
Yeah.
There are crazy calls.
Yes.
But not as many debatable and not as many, you know, fueled around the potential of danger and injury. You know, the basketball doesn't go through the hoop by accident.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't bounce off a seat and go in, you know? So there's just far more at play here. And, you know, I felt going into the first round against Washington, very encouraged with their chances. I still do. It's just all those, as I say, porridge of horror, you just never know.
That's so true. And I think that's what makes the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs the most exciting and scintillating postseason in North American professional sports. And you mentioned just sort of the bounce of a puck or just a little miscue. Ilya Samsonov changed the entire series for the Capitals and for the Bruins with his miscue leading to the double overtime game winner for Craig Smith there. And that's just completely changed the series in game three. And you wonder how different the series is if he maybe just sort of waits a little longer for Justin Schultz to get there and escort the puck out of danger.
That's right. And those are the things. Now, there's a rookie goaltender. I wouldn't say a classic rookie goaltender because he's, you know, he had good experience before he came over to North America. But yes, there you go again. I mean, there's all the factors that I talked about before and the rookie goaltender who under pressure hiccups. Now, to go through that play, the goaltender can go back, stop the puck and wheel it around and just get rid of it, buying himself enough time to get back in the net. He chose to stop it, thinking Justin Schultz was going to come over. And instead, Justin Schultz got, you know, clipped on the puck by Craig Smith, former teammates in Wisconsin, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah. So I got to think maybe that had come up in a drill or two before when they were Badgers.
That's a good point.
But he beats him to the puck. But the onus there is most on the guy who has last control of the puck. That's the goaltender. And there were a number of better options than just leaving it there and hoping your left side defenseman can win a puck race.
Speaking of goaltending, we would be remiss to have any discussion about the Boston Bruins and their chances of lifting yet another Stanley Cup if we did not talk about Tuukka Rask. The Bruins had a clear goaltending advantage in this series against the Capitals, whether it was Craig Anderson or Ilya Samsonov. Rask was very good in the series, 4-1, 1.81 goals against, 9.41 save percentage. What's interesting to me, Kevin, is it feels like every bounce of the rubber right now is a referendum on Tuukka Rask and his career.
I don't think it's ever going to change for Tuukka. Well, it would change, right? It would change if they win the cup this year. I'm sure that would put to rest whether he's the guy who can do it, because he would have done it. But because of history here, because of, you know, some people point to game 7 against St. Louis that he should have been better. There were, and yes, I mean, every goalie can stop every puck, but that's just not the way it is. Could he have been better that night? I think so, but I don't put the game 7 loss against St. Louis Stanley Cup final at home on Tuukka. Now, there was the other time in 2013 against Chicago. The game unraveled very quickly, turned into a cup win that night for Chicago. And, you know, Had he been better? Again, yes. I think it's easier to point a finger on those. But again, I always look at these things, unless it's as blatant as the mistake we just talked about with Samsonov.
Yeah.
I don't. I mean, that they play the game. The shots get tipped. They get stopped. I mean, there's a million variables in this. I just look at what he is in terms of a goaltender. He's won more games than any goaltender in Bruins history, both regular season and playoff. If you look at his numbers this year, and I won't get mired in the decimal points.
I like that.
Those decimal points or analytics are in direct lockstep with him backing the team to the cup in 2013 and 2019. So he's an elite goaltender. You can always find better, but I think he's fine. That said, I also think it's somewhat of a surprise that he's still here because he did, as we remember, he left the bubble last year. And this is another factor on the Tuukka hate list or the, you know, Tuukka's fault list of, you know, he when he left the team in the bubble last year and there was no stated reason why he was leaving that day, it later came out, according to Tuukka, he had to leave for a family emergency for a young daughter. Now, I would hope anybody would cut the guy slack.
Yes.
That being the case,
family comes first.
Family always comes first. But that said, there have been a couple of instances. That one, there was an instance a couple of years before where he left the team unexpectedly on the weekend because he needed a temporary leave of absence because things weren't right at home. I thought in tandem that would encourage them to go out and make a deal for another goalie, move Tuukka ahead of his last year of his contract here, which is now expired, but they didn't. They're wise that they didn't. But I still, frankly, these many months later, I'm surprised they didn't.
You know, when you look at Tuukka, I think here's part of the issue. And having covered the Patriots, I saw this a little bit with Stephen Gostkowski. Stephen Gostkowski was constantly compared to his predecessor, Adam Vinatieri, who came up huge in the biggest moments. And that's the situation for Tuukka with Tim Thomas in the 2011 Cup run. He came up huge in the biggest moments. And it's funny because having covered the 13 Cup run with you and the 19 Cup run, you know, with you, lucky enough to be along for the ride as a columnist, I remember that going into the Stanley Cup final, both of those years, if you track Tuukka's numbers, they actually were better than Tim Thomas's numbers in 2011. But at the end of the day, he doesn't end up winning the cup. And I feel like for Tuukka, the bar, Kevin, is we need you to steal a series, steal a cup, Patrick Waugh style, Ken Dryden style, and maybe Tim Thomas style, the way he did against the Lightning, you know, back in 2011. And until he does that, people are not going to be satisfied because they're going to constantly be comparing him to his predecessor who did that and also to the other goalies that make the type of money that he makes. And that's sort of Tuukka's gift and Tuukka's curse. You know, you're very highly paid and highly decorated and you earn that. But with that comes the expectation that you're going to be the absolute difference in some series where the team wins the cup and he hasn't been able to deliver that yet.
I can't argue those points. Yeah, they're all salient points. I have to agree. The Tim Thomas performance in 2011 was almost mythical in terms of the way he was making stops. So I don't know if anybody could come in and follow that in terms of, because Tim Thomas was not Tuukka's style, Tuukka's style being the conventional butterfly goaltender, where typically you don't see, lack of a better word, histrionic stops. They're all by, not all, but they're basically from positioning and being flared out and keeping the lower 20% of the net sealed off, 25% of the net sealed off with pads. Whereas Tim was this hybrid form. He had a fiery personality that plays into it too. He got some big breaks, including a Michael Ryder save that might have prevented them from losing to Montreal.
People forget about that. That's a great point.
Yeah. So there's and again, there's shot after shot after shot. So I try to take the wider approach, which is how does the guy play day to day, and what is his reliability factor, and that's where Tuukka is. But those things, I think we could probably a podcast for another day about whether Dryden was stealing series.
Good point.
Or Marty Brodeur, or you know, name your guy, Billy Smith. You know, you look at some of the relative strengths of those teams, like Billy Smith playing on four straight cup teams, Ken Dryden later, even in 71, there's still gnashing of the teeth among my friends who were that old that they lost to Canadiens that year. Yes, they did. 12 of those players on Canadiens are in the Hall of Fame. So, and I think three or four Bruins, so it might even be five Bruins. So it's not like they lost to bums. And then, so part of the fun of the sport is you can debate the goaltender's value in the meaning of what they mean to a playoff series. What I always say going into it is, you know, the cliche being goaltender's 50% of your equation. If you don't have it, it's 90%, if not 100%.
So sticking with the goaltending theme here, I know that there were some people, including my radio partner, Big Jim Murray, he's just kind of had it with Tuukka. There were some people who actually were sort of hoping he would flop and they would turn it over to the rookie, Jeremy Swayman. That seems highly unlikely, obviously, at this point. Do you see any scenario under which Swayman supplants Rask here as they go on this playoff run?
The only scenario I would see would be injury. And I only bring it up because I think you have to in context to Tuukka, because he got hurt late in the season. He missed some considerable time there, which is what in large part led to Swayman coming aboard. And then Swayman, because of Yaro Halak's bout on the COVID list, Swayman gave the chance, and he played extremely well against six other NHL teams. The other thing about Swayman is we've seen him in a very small sample case. Played 10, and six of those were the same team. All 10 were against six teams. I'll do the math some one of these days. So,
I was told there'd be no math, Kevin.
Yeah, I know. And I didn't bring a number two pencil. In the end, I only see it if Tuukka's back, and I think it's a lower back injury that he's been working around. And on Wednesday, their first day back at practice, Tuukka didn't participate other than to come out early and take a few shots himself. Now, that can be fatigue related. My guess is it's you know, at this time of the year, it's load management with the asterisk that he's had the injury. So if something were to happen, yes, and I think they'd be very comfortable going with Swayman, as they should. But you just never know, as the Caps found with Samsonov.
I want to ask you, as we mentioned this Capitals series, and I have to say, I was surprised. I thought this thing was going to go seven. I thought the teams were evenly matched. I felt whichever team got out of the series would be able to do some real damage. The Bruins had the advantage when it came to special teams, which was really a surprise because the Capitals were one of two teams this year that finished in the top five in the NHL in both power play percentage and penalty kill. The other still alive, at least at the time of this podcast, being the Carolina Hurricanes. The Bruins held the Caps to 3 of 21 on the power play, including 1 for 11 in the last two games. Meanwhile, the Bruins were 5 for 19 on the man advantage in the series. That's sort of a big windup to get to this point. When I think of great penalty killing defensemen, I think of Zdeno Chara. And there's been a little bit of grave dancing, I think, that the Bruins won this series in five and they beat the Capitals and Chara. And it's sort of been like, see, Don Sweeney was right to let Chara go. I'm curious what you thought of Chara in this series. And I'm also sort of curious what you think about the grave dancing when you consider the fact that the young defensemen that they wanted to clear space for Chara to go away so these guys could play really didn't have an impact on the series. Jeremy Lauzon, he was hurt. Earl Vakanainen, we didn't see. Zboril, I believe, is also hurt. I mean, they right. put Jared Tenorti into the lineup when Kevin Miller got hurt. So how did you feel Chara played? And do you feel like maybe there's a little bit of revisionist history about the fact that him not being here somehow, you know, it's vindication for Don Sweeney that they win this series?
Well, working backwards, I don't see it as vindication. I still think they would have been better to keep him, to have told him he was going to have a more prominent role, which would have been right because of how things played out with injury and just general development of those young defensemen. So I think they undersold his potential value. And I think that was true, whether they would have won or lost that series. There's many things about Chara, as we know, just in terms of, yes, put him out on the PK and play him where the Caps played him, which was about 18 minutes a game on average. I didn't look at his exact minutes for the playoffs, but it was about the same. So where they could have dialed him in Boston is where he got dialed in Washington. And I think they would have been smart to do that. Now, I will go on to say that even if the Bruins win the cup or if they get eliminated in the next round because maybe their defense doesn't hold up. I think that would have been the wise move. It wasn't a money thing, as we know. The money was fine. And they did have to go out. Not only did they suffer the vagaries of these young defensemen and them getting hurt, then they had to go out and get Tenorti. They had to go out and get Mike Riley. So there was some of this running around to fix it that they wouldn't have had to do. So as far as pointing the finger in the end of his relative value, would they have won without him? I think they would have been just fine with him staying and going forward.
What about the narrative that he had to go for McAvoy to take the mantle of leadership and develop into the type of defenseman that he is? I'll just tell you, I don't subscribe to that. McAvoy is a first round pick. I think the team has set some pretty clear expectations for him in terms of being a number one defenseman. But I don't know, you're in the room, at least you were pre-pandemic, with Chara there. Would he have just deferred to him or sort of, I don't want to say been lazy, but maybe not taken his game to the next level? Is there some validity to that theory?
It's an interesting theory. I don't subscribe to it. I think Charlie is a terrific talent. Charlie was getting lots of minutes even when Chara was here. Chara, as the first round of the playoffs played out, Charlie finally ended up on the first unit power play. That wasn't the case through the course of the year. They were using Matt Grizzlick more in that role when they were using four forwards and one defenseman. McAvoy saw some of that as second unit, but sometimes he also saw it with another defenseman back there. So that role wasn't going to change, or his development on that arc wasn't going to be affected by whether Chara was still here, because Chara wasn't playing the power play. Those minutes would have gone to Charlie anyway. I think this force of personality, which is always the case, I can't tell you how Charlie's personality has emerged for the very reason you just talked about. I've been in the room to witness it. And even then, the little glimpses that we get when we run into a room for 10 or 15 minutes may not always be a fair indication. But I think Charlie's personality will emerge more as he gets older, as he gets more games, as this playoff season plays out. But I just don't see, one thing about Chara, if one of his tenets has been not even to talk about rookies as rookies. He would insist on calling them young players or first year players or second year players. He insisted on everybody being, part of the team that pulls the rope. There was no delineation. For Chara, in terms of how he approached people, how he saw team structure, I never felt that.
So looking ahead to round two here, a little different setup this year, obviously staying in the division until you get to the semifinals. There's really no conferences anymore in this setup that the NHL had for a 56-game regular season and now the playoffs.
I don't want to undersell the Islanders, but that's not the Islander game. Yeah, Islanders win by stout defense, reliable 60, pretty much the same 60 all year. They've been fortunate in terms of the injury bug. Terrific coaching, which is not to take anything away from Mike Sullivan in Pittsburgh. But they really rely more on system, grinding, size, strength, which is kind of what the Washington series was as well, but with some very interesting high-end talent as well, of course, and Ovechkin and in Backstrom and Kuznetsov. So if I'm the Bruins, I don't know. I think they're equally problematic for different reasons, given that the Bruins just beat a team very much like Islanders. Maybe that's the preference, because you're sort of engaged in that mentality going in, or should be, and you've done well against it. I would think that would give you that tiny bit more confidence. Whereas against Pittsburgh, it can turn into a wild show quickly because of their skill. And the Bruins right now on defense, they don't know if they're going to get Kevin Miller back. Jeremy Lauzon has been dinged up. He was in a red shirt on their first practice back on Wednesday. Zboril's still down. So there's some sort of reasons to be concerned about leaks on the Boston defense that I think would be a greater problem again, could be a greater problem against Pittsburgh.
It's a little bit of a moot point now because the Bruins are a different team than they were during the regular season for the most part. You know, after the, we talked about how they sort of took off after the trade deadline. They had 25 points, the most in the NHL after the trade deadline. Here's the regular season matchup though versus these two teams. Against the Islanders, they went 3-3-2. They got off to a bad start against those guys, but then they closed strong against them. They were outscored 13-10, 5-on-5 this year. The top line was good against the Isles as well, combining for 18 points. Maybe this is the trump card, though. Taylor Hall against the Islanders in just 3 games, 4 goals.
Right. And again, that's in large part why that record did flip late in the year, because they went out and got 5-on-5 scoring. They got Taylor Hall specifically to be that. So, yes, you can argue as well that the Pittsburgh, that the Islander goaltending with Varlamov is better.
And Sorokin, who's been playing.
Right. And Sorokin, too. Yes. Who's, you know, by no means a rookie, but he is in terms of classification. So they've got terrific goaltending that's only gotten better because of Sorokin.
Do you see them as the favorite?
Yeah, I do right now because of the balance that they've put into the lineup. I picked them in 6 against the Caps. They won in 5. I would say they should be able to win both of the, beat both of these opponents in 5 or 6 is how I feel.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. No. I mean that tells you this, that this team is very much a cup contender, which is really interesting when you think about it, because we've talked about the 2011 Stanley Cup. That was 10 years ago. There's not a lot of teams that are able to have a 10 11, 12 year run, at least outside of the Red Wings. It's hard to do. And they've gone to 3 Stanley Cup finals. They've only won 1. What would another cup mean for this core, for this group and their legacy?
Well, certainly it's solidified. That said, I think, you know, what are the constant threads through these years? They're really, well, Rask had to defer to Timmy Thomas in 11, but Rask was aboard. Bergeron is the constant thread in it. Bergeron and Krejci, we undersell Krejci. I know I do, and I shouldn't, but I do. What they don't have now, of course, is the franchise defenseman. You've got him emerging in McAvoy, whereas you had it in Chara in the early part of this run. But that said, Chara himself was not a classic franchise defenseman in terms of what you think of that today, sort of in the Bork image or the Nicholas Lidstrom image, a guy who's really going to contribute offensively. Chara did more of that early on, but his trademark, of course, was his size, his defense, his penalty killing. So in terms of legacy, sure, if in the Bergeron era, if you will, they can show 4 cup finals and being successful in 2 of them, that would solidify them as certainly one of the great teams in Bruins history. That said, nothing is ever going to, even though it was 2 cups in what, 3 years, nothing's ever going to exceed the whole Big Bad Bruin or era, all of that. Nothing.
That's true.
Yeah, but certainly it would solidify it, and again it's a vastly different sport and a vastly different game.
I can't think of another difference in sports that's greater than winning one championship versus being able to say you won multiple ones. I saw it with the new Big Three Celtics of Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen. They only won one. They had some bad luck, some injury stuff. They lost to the Lakers in 2010 when Perk went down in game 6. I think it makes a huge difference historically. It won't make a difference in terms of the fondness with which this group is remembered by Bruins fans, but just historically, to be able to say you went to 4 and won 2, that looks a lot different than you went to 4 and won 1 or you went to 3 and won 1. Historically, it just says you did it more than once, which means that it wasn't, I don't want to say lucky because that's not fair, but that it wasn't a situation where it was a one-off in terms of that particular postseason. You got all the bounces and the breaks. It was nope. You were a very good team with Hall of Fame players. And sometimes when you win multiple ones, you actually go back and look at it and say, geez, they won two. But, you know, if not for a bounce here or a bounce there, they could have won three or four because they were that good.
Yes, very true. Very true. They could have won. They could have won in 13, as you know. They could have won in 19. Some added context to that is they will have done that with two general managers and two coaches. So there's been a significant constants here. It's an extremely good point you bring up. And frankly, I hadn't thought of it in that context. It's interesting.
Feel free to take that for an on hoc.
Absolutely.
Or one of your, on second thoughts.
Sunday notes, anything.
Feel free to take that because I'm not as much in the columnizing business anymore. So you're in the clear. I want to ask you this related to what we just talked about. How much longer do you think the championship window is open for the Bruins? And is this the last best shot here if they don't capitalize? I mean, Bergeron will be 36 on July 24th. Rask is 34. You mentioned he's in the last year of his deal. Krejci is in the last year of his deal and is 35. How much longer can they compete for cups? And is there this urgency here, Kevin, where this is the last best chance to add another cup?
Well, if it's longer than this, it's not much longer. So I think we're essentially at the end of it. Now, whether the end of it's going to be one or two more years, but just by sheer age and the mileage on some of these players, Bergeron, Krejci, Rask for a goaltender, the mileage is high on all of these guys. I'm not saying this is the last dance, but this is getting very close to it now. What's underneath? You know, Marchand's a little bit younger, not a lot. There's your first line. Pastrnak is significantly younger. McAvoy. So there's pieces in place here that should be able to pick it up. And you know, depending how they draft and what trades they make, and all the harder, of course, to go back to the previous conversation, one we just finished. All the harder to be doing all of this in the cap era because of the money, the free agency, the players can leave. They've done a very good job, excellent job here in Boston of maintaining that core. The challenges will be the same going forward. It's not to say that they're going to necessarily have the same success keeping players satisfied with money. I'd also say, you know, Bergeron is truly a unique player. I don't think you just go out and draft another Bergeron. They didn't know they were drafting that player when they did. Otherwise, if everybody knew that, he would have been on the top three for sure. so there's always the vagaries of not knowing how players are going to develop. But I would say the key, if you're asking me one, which you're not, what one key single reason, it has been Bergeron.
So I just want to let everybody know here, you've covered so much, not just the NHL over the years. You were once the Red Sox beat writer, and you've covered a multitude of things. And you're probably my favorite writer in the sports department just for your style of writing, and a style of writing that I definitely tried to imitate and borrowed from you. So I want to ask you this, and Ellen's going to come in really and do it. You're pretty well known for very lively, creative writing and these really interesting nicknames that you come up with. Like the Technicolor Five Hole. That was John Casey, right?
John Casey. Okay. And the amazing Technicolor.
Sorry, the amazing Technicolor Five Hole. Al, the Planet Iafredi. You call the guys that are on the Providence Bruins the wannabes. So you come up with some interesting things. So I want to bring Ellen in to talk about this.
What's your favorite nickname that you've come? What's stuck the most? And I also want to bring this back to a podcast we did. I forget who it was with.
Yeah.
But about Peyton Pritchard's nickname, Fast PP, and what your thoughts are on that, because I'm out on that one.
Yeah, nicknames can go bad quickly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, that image of a fast PP is really.
That's what I said.
Yeah. Or a short one. Yeah, no, that's not.
No, maybe just, you know, fast power play.
Or just any kind. Yeah.
Fast power play, that's what it is.
Yeah, size matters. What's my favorite? I suppose that's a good question too. My favorite, I think, is Planet because of how much I enjoyed watching Al Iafredi play, and it spoke to his otherworldly talent. That was the reason for it. You know, some of it too, he was this sort of space shot mentality. So it was this porridge of stuff that kind of played into the planet. I have to say the one I probably hear the most that people enjoy the most was Landon Wilson, Landon of the Lost, because he was just, there was so much there and it never came around. So that's where that one came from.
Did you ever what about one for Chris?
A nickname for Chris?
Yeah.
I don't think we ever had one.
Yeah, no, I always called you the gas man in the office.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Do these just come to you off the top of your head when you're writing? Do you think about it? If you just use it one time on deadline and copy, do you know you're going to use it again? Have you used ones one time and copy and then been like, I don't like that and changed it?
No. I've certainly turned in a fair amount of copy where the desk says it doesn't like it and they take it out.
Oh, okay.
they tell me they're taking it out.
Okay.
They get sick of it, so they don't want to hear it anymore. I have to say, if there's inspiration behind this, it was Bud Collins, because Bud was great at in the tennis game of coming up with them. And I love the Belleville Basher and all that, the Sisters Sledgehammer with the Williams girls. Right. So, I always enjoyed that. I enjoyed nicknames as a kid playing around with them. You know, do I deliberately sit down and try to? No, I don't. I guess they just come for better or worse. Yeah.
Now I mean, it's pretty cool. What about Hub of Hockey? Isn't that yours? And I know the Bruins have used it. Do you get any residuals from that?
No, there's no residuals. I started using it around the same time as Hockey Town became available during the whole great Red Wings dynasty, if you will, or their great run. It's a dynasty.
Yeah.
So I was using Hub of Hockey here. Of course, it really wasn't. They weren't winning much at the time, so part of it was tongue in cheek. But it did stick. I still see it sometimes today. At one point, Charlie Jacobs was newer on the block, if you will. He did write me asking for permission to use it.
Really?
Yeah. I still have that email somewhere. Which, what was I going to do? Was I going to go out and patent it? Maybe I should have.
Yes, you should have trademarked that.
Yeah, I probably should have.
I think you'd own the Boston Globe, not work for the Boston Globe, if you'd done that.
I did have a personal friend who was also an agent telling me at the time that I should have done that. But to do over, who knows? Maybe I would have chosen to do that.
So when you really think about it, I mean, go back to, you know, Don Cherry, Harry Sinden, Ray Bourque, Cam Neely, Zdeno Chara, the list goes on and on. You've outlasted them all. How much longer would you like to do this, Kevin?
Well, it crosses my mind. A number of them probably wish I'd retired already.
You know, our good friend Bob Ryan is sort of semi-retired, and I think that's ideal. Yeah. He still writes every once in a while. But, you know, how much longer do you want to be the national hockey writer, national hockey columnist for the Boston Globe, where you're tied to the season?
Yeah. I don't have a definitive answer for you, and I wish I did. And some of that is not to get too wrapped up in psychotherapy, but it's sort of like what are the things you enjoy most doing in life, right? Certainly I've loved this. I've done it for almost 50 years now. I've loved, you know, there've been some bad days, obviously, but overall I've loved what I've done. I've loved doing it. I've worked for some great people, some great bosses. Most of all at the Globe in terms of editors, and it's a writer's paper. It's just been a great luxury and a great blessing. Lately I'm falling back on my good friend, Red Fisher, the late good friend, Red Fisher's line. Red did it well into his 80s. He always said, I'm going to stay until I get it right. So some of that is just feeling like loving what I do, loving the competition of it, which has always been sort of what hasn't been necessarily the writing. And the competition is much different today than it was when I started doing it in the mid-70s, say. When there was, we didn't have as many people doing it. When you did win that day, the victory lasted longer. Whereas now the victory only lasts a matter of seconds if you're first with breaking news. So there's a lot in it. It's very difficult to let it go. And I think what I'm most thankful for now is not only for having done it this long, but as we speak today, still enjoying good health. And so I'll do it for a little while longer, but I don't think much longer.
Kevin, we've been jumping in about how things have changed. The game has changed since the last time the Bruins won the Cup.
Yeah.
The game of writing has changed. How do you think throughout COVID, how have you felt about the games being played back to back? I'm just a very casual hockey fan. I've felt like teams have become more aggressive because they're playing back to back. So people are holding on to those grudges, knowing what people, what to expect. You learn every single time you play someone and now you're playing them the next day. So what have you thought about the back to back scheduling?
I'm not fond of back to back nights just because of the physical toll of the game and the risk of injury. That's always in it. And it only increases when you're playing two games over the course of 24 to 28 hours. So I'm not a fan of that. I did like the back to backs in terms of, you know, a lot of things. Teams get to go to a city and stay there for a couple of days and not move out. So I'm okay with that. I liked it. But I don't think we're going to see the league embrace it routinely, only because there's so many teams.
Right.
And I still think there's going to be that demand league-wide, team to team to team, to want their fans to be able to see every team in their building every year. And I think that's a healthy desire. Now that said, there's a lot of those teams every year that are on the downswing or have been down for a while that, okay, who cares? But that's cyclical too. So I don't see that they're going to do much of it. Certainly within the division, they can do it a little more. But I think by and large, if we ever get back to pre-pandemic programming, I think they'll embrace the old model more.
Yeah, that's kind of just like, I feel like even our workplace, a lot of workplaces are going back to what was pre-pandemic lifestyles, normal, get back to where we were before we liked it then. So back onto that, what do you see going forward when it comes to Canada and the playoffs? Obviously, Canada is still under a lot of restrictions when it comes to COVID. I read earlier, I think only like 3% of Canadian players are vaccinated at this point.
And the border's closed.
And the border is closed, which that makes it tough to get over.
Yeah.
So what are you hearing? I know nothing's official, but what are you hearing?
A few scenarios. And I don't know if any of them has any more juice than the other, but one scenario would be, and this has been standing for a while, league asking for special dispensation because it's hockey and because it's Canada, that they would be allowed to go back and forth. The only way I could see Canada relaxing that is if they change the format over the final in the semifinal round and maybe the final if the Canadian team lasts, which would be rather than go, as we've known it for decades, 2-2, 1-1, 1, go to a 2-3-2 format. So there'd be at least a better chance of mitigating maybe one game there of not having to go back over. Or maybe a 3-4 format that you play 3 in America, 4 in Canada, 4 in Canada, 3 in America, specific to those rounds. And another one in play, and this one probably feels like it's more likely to me, which is the Canadian-based city where they're not allowing fans into the buildings anyway, by and large, the Canadian-based city would move to an American city where the NHL team isn't playing. I'll use Buffalo as an example. Buffalo hasn't made the playoffs since the 1920s. Toronto, for instance, would take on the Key Bank Center in Buffalo as its home base. And then those two teams, the displaced or replaced the Toronto team, would travel back and forth to wherever it had to go.
Very interesting. Well, we'll get you out on this one. Another one of your nicknames, Jumbo Joe Thornton.
Ah,
he's still kicking with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Scored a goal, became the oldest Maple Leaf to score in the postseason. Are you surprised that he's still playing? And does he need a cup in any way to validate what has been a Hall of Fame career?
Am I surprised? I guess when any player is this at this age in this game because of the speed, I am surprised, yes. So now Chara gets around it because of great positioning sense. Joe's not as fast as he used to be, but I give him great credit. He stays with the play. Now he stays with the play in this format or in this scheme with Toronto on playing third, fourth line role. You know, every team should be that blessed to have his talent on a third or fourth line. I think of Joe just as I think of Jean Rattel, who never won a cup, be it with the Rangers or the Bruins, which is distinguished career, great numbers, has been a solid citizen. So I personally don't think he needs it. I don't think anyone else should think that Joe needs a cup to you know, crystallize his career in any way. I would have felt the same way about Ray Bourque, but I think the players, as Ray Bourque is a perfect case, the players feel they need it, they want it. And I suppose if I went 20 years and came up short for 20 years, I damn well want it too.
Yeah, he's kind of like the Susan Lucci of hockey, or the old thing when they talk about in golf, you know, who's the best player to never win a major? That's kind of where Jumbo Joe Thornton is. All right, we will leave it there with the one and only Kevin Paul DuPont of the Boston Globe. You can obviously catch his stuff on the Globe. You're also going to want to follow him on Twitter. He always has some good witticisms there. He's a noted hockey historian and humorist, so I hope you got some information on the NHL and a few laughs out of Kevin here on the Take 5 podcast. Kevin, it was a pleasure.
My friends, thank you. Thank you, Ellen. We'll do it again.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.